Section 1. Isn't this just bunk? In 1999, I wrote an exposé for Skeptical Inquirer on a then-recent Fox documentary about ancient Egypt. I had never been interested in the crazy theories going around about the pyramids, but when a major television network started presenting them as credible news, and with suspect tactics at that, it offended me as a historian. So I investigated the claims in the documentary, contacting some who were interviewed for it, and wrote on what I found. The show's editors had quoted interviews out of context, conflated credible with ridiculous claims, mixed serious scholars with lay theorists as if there were no difference in their credibility, made several claims that were highly dubious if not outright false, while rarely presenting any criticism and then only a token, and sometimes even misrepresented or didn't honestly reveal to those being interviewed what the actual intent of the documentary was and how their interview would be used. Some of those interviewed were rightly outraged at what Fox had done. Thanks to that article, however, I had sealed my fate. Ever since, I've been the target of countless emails from kooks that some people call pyramidiots, people who passionately advocate bizarre and often, let's be honest, stupid theories about the pyramids. They were built in 20,000 BCE. Their builders must have used lasers and levitation rays. Psychics have predicted archaeological discoveries in them. Their configuration proves the existence of extraterrestrial civilizations or the preternatural wisdom of the ancients or the existence of God and the intelligent design of the universe, and so on. They typically have some 1,000-page treatise they want me to read that, they insist, proves their new outlandish claim, and if I don't read it, I'm participating in the quote-unquote conspiracy to suppress their research. Yet I will never live long enough to examine and fact-check all the theories, books, and papers these people have tried to send me, even if I made it my single purpose in life to try. So I don't waste even a minute on any of them. I dismiss them all out of hand. Their emails and treatises go right in the trash. I will, however, send them one email in reply with a simple rule. Get even one of their novel claims published in a peer-reviewed journal specializing in Egyptology or archaeology, or in a book published by a respected academic or peer-reviewed press, and then I'll read it. They will insist they can't because of some conspiracy by the quote-unquote establishment to prevent acceptance of any such paper, either for some ordinary or paranoid reason. It differs with each one. But as a professional in the field, I know firsthand that's just bunk. If you really have the evidence and can prove it, the scholarly community will usually publish it. Our conversation then ends. This isn't the only subject on which I get this kind of crank email. It was just, for a time, the most pronounced and continuous. And silly, since I'm not an Egyptologist and have no interest in the field. I only published on the subject as a journalist, and that only once long ago. But I've published more widely on numerous other subjects and built a reputation as a skeptic and expert in various other areas, which inevitably attract similar people, from creationists to ufologists and everything in between. My response is always the same. After all, I have no choice. If I can't examine every pyramidiot scheme in a lifetime, I certainly can't examine every nutty scheme in hundreds of other fields besides. Hence my rule. Unless they get something published properly, I'm not warranted in spending any time on it. That's the way it has to be. So when I was approached by people claiming Jesus didn't exist, I simply assumed this was more of the same. Since I'm an expert in ancient history, and particularly in historical methods and the origins of Christianity, it at least made more sense why advocates of that crazy idea would start sending me things. But more than that happened. A growing number of skeptics, not just advocates, started approaching me and asking about these claims. They said the arguments sounded pretty convincing, and they hadn't seen any credible debunking of them, yet weren't qualified themselves to know if they were being duped by sloppy or dishonest scholarship. I responded to these sincere inquiries with the same general reply. The non-existence of Jesus is simply not plausible, as arguments from silence in the matter aren't valid, nor could they ever be sufficient to challenge what is, after all, the near-universal consensus of well-qualified experts. I would briefly explain why, but then more questions would come. Occasionally, I would point out what was wrong with this or that ridiculous claim, either factually or methodologically. There is certain plenty of nonsense going around from deniers of Jesus' historicity, so it's never hard to find something too silly to credit. But eventually enough people in the atheist and skeptical community, people whose judgment I trusted, were asking me to at least read The Jesus Puzzle by Earl Doherty and report on its merits, which was published by the Canadian Humanist Press in 2000, with a sequel, Jesus, Neither God Nor Man, published in 2009. He wasn't the only or the first author to argue the point, but everyone agreed he was the one who made the most convincing case. Normally, as with all crank claims, I wouldn't acquiesce, but instead insist that Doherty get at least one peer-reviewed paper published before I'd bother. He had, in the Journal of Higher Criticism, but as that journal has the specific agenda of publishing essentially those kinds of argument, an appearance there wasn't an entirely convincing reason to pay more attention. But once the number of requests from respectable people reached a tipping point, I decided I'd give his book a go, hoping that would be the end of it, and I would at least get a good article out of it, which I could then direct everyone to once and for all. I resolved to essentially peer review his book, the way I would any paper submitted to a journal. But the result surprised me. I found his book well-researched, competently argued, devoid of any of the ridiculous claims I'd heard from other historicity deniers, and more convincing than I'd thought possible. In my critical review, I pointed out the merits and flaws of his book, including the sorts of things I would insist upon as a peer reviewer before accepting it for academic publication. But on balance, the merits were greater. He had a good case. I wasn't entirely convinced, but I was convinced the subject deserved more research. And so my journey began.